The following episode of The Projection Booth is brought to you by Diabolik DVD. Specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray, please visit www.diabolikdvd.com.
This man has $6 million worth of heroin. It belongs to the mob, and all it will cost him is his life. American International Pictures presents The Italian Connection. The Italian Connection, the story of an international manhunt. With a cast of international stars, Luciano Paluzzi, Cyril Cusack, and Henry Silva and Woody Strode as the hunters.
I want you to kill him in the most brutal way possible. Because I want it to be conspicuous, sensational. In other words, make it obvious that the job was commissioned by the New York bosses.
They've come 5,000 miles to stalk their prey. Now, they're moving in for the kill. Godfather signs your death warrant. There's no place in the world you can hide.
Hurry! Shoot him!
The Italian Connection. Make it, you'll make a fortune. Miss it, you'll get a little round hole right between your eyes.
Welcome to another episode of The Projection Booth. I'm Mike White. Joining me this week is Eurocrime documentary film director Mike Malloy. Mike, welcome to The Projection Booth.
Hey, so how come I keep getting invites based on my love of Eurocrime movies? When's somebody going to step up and interview me about my unswerving love of, Big Mama's House 2?
Oh, hey. If you want to do a whole Big Mama series, we can do that sometime.
It's sometime. It's not too late right now, right?
Well, you know, I'm going to have to find Martin and interview him and all that kind of stuff. So we're going to have to wait a little
bit. I can't even
continue
this joke because, I don't know anything about Big Mama.
We've been talking about doing an episode of The Projection Booth for a while now, and I'm glad we're finally able to have the opportunity to do it. I'll tell you that before I saw your doc, I knew nothing about Eurocrime. I mean, I'm more of like a Jean-Pierre Melville kind of guy. I've seen some other French films, but they're a whole different animal than what we're talking about, the rougher and tumbler world of Italian movies. So, Mike, tell me, what drew you to Eurocrime, both as a fan and as a filmmaker?
Well, I first started seeing these films in high school and college, and I wasn't seeking out European crime films. I was just watching Charles Bronson movies, Lee Van Cleef movies, Jack Palance, Telly Savalas. Didn't really, know that these movies even constituted a genre. And kind of embarrassingly, in college, people were asking me what kind of movies I liked, and I just told them, oh, I'm very much into the, French and Italian films of the late 60s and early 70s. And I'm sure they envisioned me watching some kind of, French or Italian New Wave movies, and here I am watching these movies with, a guy forcing a power drill into the back of the skull of another guy. So, I didn't even realize that this was a genre that was the follow-up, the action follow-up in Italy to the spaghetti western. Years later, I got into these movies in earnest. I wanted to do the documentary. It's kind of only now, in retrospect, that I see what my attraction to them was. because, yeah, I like action and tough guy movies, but I really need for something to ring true to life in the movies that I really love. You know, you may see all the crazy violence and stuff in Eurocrime movies and think, well, how does that ring true to life? But in a way, kind of not necessarily connected to the story, these movies are so amazingly authentic. And that's because of the way they were made, just by circumstance, you know, forcing their, you know, leading men and all the cast to perform their own stunts. And the fact that, you know, the real life organized crime got involved in the producing of some of these movies, that gave these films kind of a weird authenticity that is, you know, basically unparalleled in all of cinema.
So tell me, how did the doc come about? I mean, had you just reached a saturation point with all these films and you said, I need to share this information with the world, or what happened?
I was kind of driven to the poorhouse by film journalism. I was building my career up to be a film critic and a cinema book author. And, you know, I'd paid my dues of working for free for years. And then I started getting paid and started getting better and better assignments. And I was almost at the point where I was barely able to eke out a living doing it. Almost at that point. I was really looking forward to it. And then the bottom dropped out. You know, the Times let go of, you know, a third of their writers, LA Times, that is, Chicago Tribune, Atlanta Journal-Constitution. They fired all these writers, or, you know, bought them out or whatever. So all of a sudden, my competition for writing gigs increased by like 8,000%. So I decided to get proactive about my career and thought maybe I can move my film commentary into cinema documentaries. So I cut a 3-minute trailer for Eurocrime, because that was my kind of cinematic obsession at the time. And my original co-producer, Kayla Janice, got that to a broadcaster, and the broadcaster said, hey, we like this. This is before we had any interviews. So that allowed me to kind of jump headlong into the project.
What kind of time frame are we talking about here? Because I'm figuring the bottom's dropping out, what, like mid-2000, first for the aughts in there, or where was this?
Well, it was in 07, I think, around when all those buyouts started happening. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that was around the time that I had a book contract to write Movie Tough Guys of the 1970s. After I had done 2 years of research and writing on it for a 4-year book contract, my house got burglarized, and the thugs, they boosted both my laptop and my backup drive. So I lost 2 years of writing and research down the drain in 30 seconds. I was a film critic for a weekly paper in Atlanta, and they got many months behind in paying me. And I said, guys, you know, I want to keep writing for you, but let's get caught up before I keep writing for you. And they said, Mike, we'd like that too. We just have no idea when that'll be. So yeah, I decided, you know, I was seeing the handwriting on the wall, and I tried to make the transition.
Well, you're probably seeing the handwriting on the wall. You're probably also seeing the pixels on the screen, all the bloggers that you're competing against at that time as well.
Oh, yeah. That still is a business model that has yet to really monetize. So, yeah, we're in a big transition. Yeah, lucky me. I decide to be a writer. And after thousands of years of that being a noble profession, all of a sudden it becomes a non-paying profession in my lifetime.
Right. When you started the doc, how did you go about it? I mean, obviously you wanted to do a lot of interviews, get as much information as you possibly could. I mean, tell the folks at home, you've got an amazing roster of interviews in this film. Just give us a, like, you know, tip of the iceberg of some of the folks that you were trying to get and who you finally did get to be in the film.
Well, basically, I mean, at the risk of sounding smug, who didn't we get, huh? Isn't that the question, Mike? No, yeah.
Well, I can think of one guy, so.
Well, yeah, there are a couple of notable omissions, but it wasn't through lack of trying. Anybody who is not in the doc is either somebody who declined an interview or was somebody that we were told in advance that we wouldn't be able to afford. That's the dirty secret sometimes, is that there are honorariums involved. Through the interviews that I did, and through the interviews conducted by my co-producer Mike Martinez, and through the interviews done in Rome by the fabulous Federico Cadeo, yeah, we got anybody who would say yes. We got stars like John Saxon, Franco Nero, Henry Silva, Fred Williamson, Luke Miranda, Antonio Sabato, all these leading men. Then we got character actors. We got one actress. We got a stuntman. We got two dubbers, two directors, a writer, even an old school cinema manager. The one kind of major creative demographic that we missed out on, to my dismay and chagrin, is a composer. Because the music of these movies is, you know, almost as popular as the movies themselves these days in this kind of revival. So it's a minor bummer that we didn't get a composer.
So what were some of the challenges that you had? I mean, obviously getting all these people was one of them. And what were some of the other things that you faced?
at this level of filmmaking, especially at this time, you know, it's kind of a catch-22. You can wait around for a budget and the proper circumstances, but then you might never get going. So you can kind of, like I said, jump in headlong, as we did, see what work can be done for low dough or on a favor basis, and you can make a film. You can make still a great film. The problem is that people will ask, well, you know, why do you have a wrinkled backdrop in this interview here? And why was this looks like it's shot in a hotel room and stuff like that? And your initial reaction is to feel bad as if you did something wrong when, in fact, you know, you busted your ass and you made something out of nothing. That's one thing I definitely learned. You do what you can do. It's interesting. The film industry kind of in general increasingly became a tougher market during the course of Eurocrime's production, which was began in late 2007. You know, development money, not non-existent these days. Upfront budgets, tough to come by. But when I started, people told me, you know, Mike, you get a bunch of great interviews and you're going to get finishing funds. Well, you know, that didn't happen. But then they said, Mike, you get a trailer that catches people's attention, you're surely going to get finishing funds. Well, no finishing funds. Then it was create a rough cut. Then it was, you know, well, it looks like you're going to have to get a finished film. So now basically I have a finished film. We're still dealing with the issue of the clips that we used, but it's very much a case of distributors wanting, well, what Henry Silva in The Italian Connection called, they want it gift wrapped. So, yeah, they want everything 100% squared away before they'll even talk to you these days. So
it seems like in the last few years that there's some sort of thing going on where folks are looking at different subgenres of films. I mean, you had the Machete Maidens, you had the Not From Hollywood, the Ozploitation stuff. And I'm sure that, you know, the horror films kind of get their own, well, we're going to look at slashers or vampires or all these different, you know, subsections of them. Why Eurocrime for you? I mean, was it just because of your love of it? And what kind of stuff did you discover while you were making this film? Because you came in, I think, probably as a little bit of an expert, and you're walking away from this, or eventually will walk away from this, as just completely steeped in this. What were some of the surprises that you found?
To answer your first question, any documentary about Italian genre filmmaking is a fascinating subject, or is going to be a fascinating subject, just by virtue of the way they made movies. They had very little TV up through the like late 70s, so they watched many more movies, meaning they had to make movies very quickly over there, which meant they shot without live sound, dubbed everything later, and created Foley and everything later. They stole shots, meaning that they would just go out in the public, even gunfights and car chases, just go out in the public and do it, not getting permission, not allowing bystanders to know that a movie was being made. You know, leading men perform their own stunts, partly out of machismo and partly out of just that's the run and gun style of Italian filmmaking. So any Italian genre filmmaking documentary, I think, would be fascinating. I think Eurocrime, of them all, is the most fascinating subject because, like spaghetti westerns, sword and sandal movies, you know, yeah, you can have allegories and stuff to the current political stuff, but they're not specifically or strictly relevant to what was going on. Eurocrime actually addressed stuff that was going on. Yeah, it was escapist entertainment on one hand. On the other hand, it was just really relevant topical stuff dealing with organized crime and communist terrorism going on in Italy in the 70s.
What kind of time frame are we talking about here? I mean, there's the 70s. Was there a specific date in the 60s? Was this happening in the 60s, or did it take place starting at a certain year in the 70s? And where would you say that it end? What are your bookends of the genre for you?
Yeah, you mentioned the Melville films. The French seemed more interested in it in the 60s, but there were Italian films. The 60s Eurocrime movies, French and Italian, they were kind of film noir-ish. They had a lot of bank heist caper movies, stuff like that. Then after the Americans, because the Italians are notoriously, you know, copycats as far as their genre filmmaking, at least they were. 1971, Dirty Harry, The French Connection. 1972, The Godfather. That was the beginning in earnest of Eurocrime, the Italian version of Eurocrime. They started all these kind of their own variants on Dirty Harry and The Godfather, and it basically was the dominant action genre from 72 to 80.
I know you had mentioned in your documentary about the way that spaghetti westerns would start to parody themselves. Was there a rash of parody Eurocrime films?
There were. Tomas Milian, the kind of, we call him the clown prince of the Eurocrime genre. He was popular all throughout, but he really became a giant commercial success when he started doing this series. He made a series of undercover cop movies with a character named Nico Giraldi, and He made 11 of those movies. They were that popular.
Wow. Did Terrence Hill get back involved with some of the parody stuff? Because I know he was good for the Trinity films back in the Spaghetti Western days.
Yeah, yeah. He and his sidekick, Bud Spencer, yeah, they reemerged in uniform. And yeah, they did a handful. But it really was the Tomas Milian comedy. Man, he was, you know, those may even prove to have a bigger life in Italy than the Eurocrime movies, just because they were such... It's kind of like the insult to Western fans is the Blazing Saddles is the highest grossing Western in the U.S. of all time. Same kind of thing. Those movies were just immensely popular, the parodies. But yeah, they basically spell the death of the genre because nobody takes them seriously anymore.
Has there ever been any kind of resurgence? Could you point to any films that have been made over the last, 30 years that exemplify the tropes that were going on in the Eurocrime films?
There's some low-budget homages out there, direct Eurocrime homages. The subject matter of, like, organized crime and terrorism is getting revisited now because you have films like Gomorrah, which was an art house film over here. You have Il Divo. You have that German Bader-Meinhof complex, which is about... communist terrorism in Germany in the 70s. So those subjects are coming back. Plus, you know, filmmakers, you know, of course, Tarantino has used soundtrack cues from Eurocrime movies in some of his films. Even Steven Soderbergh, even this rock movie, The Faster, used some soundtrack, Eurocrime soundtrack music. So yeah, its influence is being felt.
All right, so let's go ahead and we're going to take a break here. And when we come back, we will talk more in earnest about the Italian Connection.
And now, a word from our sponsor.
Specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray, Diabolik DVD has been owned and operated by the same fine folks for the last 10 years. They proudly feature in-demand titles by companies like Mondo Macabro, Synapse Films, Blue Underground, Arrow UK, Severin, and many others. Get prompt shipping to anywhere around the world and quick replies to your customer service questions. Follow them on Facebook and stop over at DiabolikDVD.com. Because you heard this on the Projection Booth podcast, take 10% off your $75 order today using the coupon code DiabolikDB10. That's DiabolikPB10. Visit DiabolikDVD.com today.
Ahoy, mateys. This is KAB, Antonio Bay. Stevie Wayne here, beaming a signal across the sea. I'll be here playing music all through the witching hour. I'm still waiting to hear from that weatherman. But in the meantime, stay here with me. Be sure to visit our sponsor, Paracinema Magazine. They're the source for all your genre movie needs. Check them out online at paracinema.net. Tell them Stevie sent you. Keep me turned on for a while, and I'll do my best to do the same for you.
The smooth sound. Fabulous 1340 KAB.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. For a limited time, you'll get 50% off just about any one item at AdamandEve.com. Yes, get 50% off when you use the coupon code BOOTH at checkout, as in John Wilkes Powers or the Projection Booth. But that's not all. You'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs and free shipping on your entire order. Too good to be true? It's not. Check out AdamandEve.com today for this special offer. Once again, that coupon code is BOOTH at AdamandEve.com.
GGTMC live for you, fresh yeah. Big Willie and the Samurai are at your service, breaking films down and turning them around, giving recommendations that are always on point. Visit ggtmc.com for more information. The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema. Bringing class to the trash since 1977.
This is Mo. Nothing so odd about him, you may be thinking, except possibly the way he's looking at your barely legal cheerleader daughter. But he seems to have his life together. He has a job, a scooter, a house in the woods with a crawl space full of dolls' heads and empty beer cans. He's all American, rosy cheek, and proud of his heritage. But Mo, like so many others, is hiding a debilitating affliction. He is unable to stop himself from watching really bad movies. The disease has a long, cumbersome Latin name you couldn't hope to understand, but trust me, it's really serious. Left to his own devices, Mo can consume up to 15 truly horrendous motion pictures in under a day. His addiction reached its low point when his friend Bosch, who was just meant to be visiting for the evening, spent almost 3 days incapacitated under a metric ton of black clamshell VHS cases, surviving off nothing but old stale Buncher Crunch and Junior Mints. Mo barely noticed. There is hope, however, and you can help. For just no money at all, you can download an episode of the Drunk on VHS podcast on iTunes or go to drunkonvhs.blogspot.com and donate nothing whatsoever but your hard-earned time. $0 is all it costs to subscribe to all the episodes and possibly, who knows, save a child. A disease like this can never hope to be cured, but it can be controlled and carefully managed in small doses, or as scientists like to call them, podcasts. We here at the Second Unit Podcast Network are bringing together people like Mo and giving them a forum in which to safely cope with their addiction. You may think it's rare, but a VHS drunkard could be anywhere. That curious uncle you have who at family gatherings wants to show you his collection of nudie playing cards. The disheveled man in your office with the unsuitably long beard and a cubicle picture of Lorenzo Lamas. Hell, it could even be you. Donate by downloading the Drunk on VHS podcast today and support just one of the members of the Second Unit Podcast Network, fighting to make your internet a safe haven for freaks.
Okay, after that rather involved preamble, when we're talking about getting together for an episode, I asked you to choose a movie that exemplifies Eurocrime to you. Of course, you came back with about a handful of suggestions before we finally settled on Fernando De Leo's Italian Connection. And like any good Italian film, it also has quite a few aliases. So let's see. It's also known as La Mala Ordina.
Right, La Mala Ordina, or also Hired to Kill.
Hired to Kill and Man on the Run.
Man on the Run and The Hitman.
The Hitman and Manhunt in the City.
Well, actually, Manhunt in the City, yes, it does get attributed to Manhunt a lot. They're both Eurocrime movies starring Henry Silva. To the best of my knowledge, Manhunt in the City has only been used as a title for the Henry Silva Vigilante movie directed by Umberto Lenzi. Then further clouding the issue is the fact that Silva made an Italian film in the 80s also called Manhunt. So,
damn you, IMDb. Regardless, there's still my favorite alternate title for the Italian Connection, which is Black Kingpin.
Black Kingpin, right. Then also various titles in Spanish, French, German, yada, yada.
Yeah, so I'm sure Black Kingpin must have been the Blaxploitation retitling in order to play up Woody Strode's role.
Yeah, I think it was a budget video retitling. The attempt to repackage it as Blaxploitation happened also with the Italian war film Inglourious Basterds, which was retitled G.I. Bro in a budget release to kind of play up Fred Williamson's role in that.
I almost felt a little bit sorry for Woody because he just barely had any lines and he kept having to play second banana to Henry Silva.
Yeah, but Woody Strode, man, those are some pretty wooden, well, taking after his name, perhaps, wooden line deliveries in that. So maybe he was downplayed for a reason, but at least he got to catch the eye of the beautiful lady in the blue afro wig.
Hey, wait a minute. I saw you first.
Wrong. I saw you first, and I said to myself, that is a real bummer. What are you doing in an Italian nightclub? Too old to be butchered in Vietnam?
You know Luca Canali?
I haven't seen him for a long time.
Is there any other club where we might be able to find Luca?
You know something? If you'd offered me the 100,000, I wouldn't have accepted. Why don't we go home and go to bed, okay?
Before you get me started on all the attractive women that were in the film, why don't you give the listeners some idea of what the movie was about?
Two New York hitmen, mafia hitmen, Henry Silva and Woody Strode. They are flown to Milan to track down a pimp called Luca Canali, who's played by Mario Adorf, who is apparently of German descent, but is one of the swarthiest looking actors you'll ever see. So these two mafia hitmen are supposed to kill him in a really conspicuous manner to make an example of him, because they've been told that Luca Canali swiped a shipment of mafia heroin. And when they start coming after him, it's very apparent that Luca has no idea why the mafia is chasing him. So what results is a fabulous manhunt, a manhunt in the city even, with Luca desperately trying to, you know, find some safe haven, but all his friends and associates are trying to, you know, kind of sell him out. The fact that the mob wants him, right or wrong, seems to be all that matters. It doesn't matter whether he's guilty or not.
And now, without seeing your documentary, I would have enjoyed the film. But after seeing Eurocrime, or I should say Eurocrime, the Italian cop and gangster films that ruled the 70s, it made me appreciate it all the more, especially when they broke out the J&B right at the beginning of the film. That was awesome.
Yeah, that is perhaps the drinking game of Eurocrime, is spot the J&B bottle.
Yeah, now I see J&B everywhere, not just in European films, but I see it in American films now, and it just, it takes me back, makes me laugh every time. I was watching Easy Money the other day, and sure enough, Tom Noonan was drinking J&B at a strip club, so I was really happy about that. How does Italian Connection fit in with the other Eurocrime films? I mean, I know other than the J&B, what other kind of stuff would you say, like, oh, this completely exemplifies what Eurocrime is about? I mean, first off, it seems like the use of the American actors. You've got Silva and Strode at the forefront, but really they're kind of, I won't say that they're second bananas, but really they're not even the focus of the movie. It really seems to be that Mario Adolfo guy who just has that amazing face. He just looks so good in close up.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, you asked two questions there. You alluded to two things. What exemplifies this Italian Connection exemplifies about the genre? What I like about it is my favorite Eurocrime movies have this kind of theme of one man against the world. Because Eurocrime movies break down to cop movies and gangster movies. But either way, the best of them are one man against the world. You either got a cop who's railing against, you know, the criminal scum out on the streets, plus his bureaucratic superiors who want to tie his hands with red tape. Or in the case of the gangsters, you have, you know, some kind of criminal underworld lowlife who's both been, you know, he's on the run from the law on the one hand, and on the other hand, he's on the run from the syndicate that, you know, he's double-crossed and the syndicate now wants him dead, that kind of thing. So this is perfect example of that. Mario Adorf in this has no idea why he's wanted, but he's wanted. And everywhere he turns, somebody's trying to sell him out. You also allude to the fact that, you know, the kind of the changing perspective or point of view of the film. Yeah, you're introduced to the whole story through the characters of the hitmen, Henry Silva and Woody Strode. And you just presume that what you're being told is the truth, that Luca Canali is guilty of swiping this heroin. You think that these guys are going to be the protagonists, and you kind of cheer for them in certain scenes, like Henry Silva, that fabulous scene where he shows up and says, "So the little birdie got away right over the f***ing rainbow." You know, he's just totally cheerworthy in that scene. But throughout the course of the film, you realize, holy crap, this, you know, small time pimp Luca Canali is, man, what, he's just with total dogged perseverance. He's fighting for his life against all odds. So he really wins you over.
Yeah, because he seems like a nice enough guy. I mean, even though when we're first introduced to him and he's like smacking that dude across the face and everything.
Well, but that's one of the things I like about the movie is how all these little details, because I think in that scene he headbutts the guys. You know, they could have just made Luca Canali a scrappy little brawler and he could have just gotten into fistfights the whole movie. But they gave him the signature move, the headbutt. He headbutts people, inanimate objects. He headbutts everything in this thing.
I do like that. And then when the cop comes up and he's smacking the guy and then he just starts, like, you know, lightly he's touching him across the face, you know.
Yeah. Oh. He was feeling faint.
Yes. Luca was just being a nice guy. And, you know, he's got the family and everything. And so, yeah, I really started to empathize with this guy almost right from the beginning. And it was like, why is this guy, you know, it just didn't ring true. So I was glad that they really followed up on that. And they delivered everything that they seemed to set up at the beginning. So I was really happy about that.
Yeah, it also exemplifies, besides the American actors, Henry Silva and Woody Strode, you got some Bond actors, some Bond alumni in this. And that's also kind of typical of Eurocrime because, you know, European actors. So you got the Dolfo Celli, who's, you know, I think was one of the Blofelds. He's the mob boss in this. And then you got former Bond girl Luciana Paluzzi, who's the redhead, who's kind of there when the two Americans arrive. She's kind of their guide to Milano.
Is Eurocrime kind of a misnomer? Should it be called Italiocrime or something? Or was it that, is it called Eurocrime because of all the different European actors that would get involved in this?
Well, in co-productions, too, because very few of the movies were made strictly in with Italian money. They would, you know, co-finance it with West Germany, with France, with Spain, sometimes with Turkey, even. And that's, we really were pleased to get an interview with Richard Harrison, because he made a bunch of Italian, Turkish Crime co-productions, and man, the Turks just have this totally different way of filmmaking. He tells these stories about how Turkish actors love to stagger around for like 10 minutes before they fall down and die. So he said he'd yell action, let the actor stagger around for like 5-10 minutes or something, then he'd have the camera switched on right before they fell so that they didn't burn up a bunch of film.
That's too great. Now, Richard Harrison, son of George Harrison from the Beatles, correct?
Oh, but of course, of course. Oh,
okay. Just making sure on that so we can continue.
Actually, he normally gets mistaken with Richard Harris. Richard Harrison was kind of a frustrating interview because he gave such amazing anecdotes of just this amazing crime stuff and real-life crime that happened. But he's such a cool, laid-back, laconic kind of guy that he told all these stories as if they're nothing. You know, it's kind of frustrating as a filmmaker. You want to convince the audience that what they're seeing is exciting and important and, you know, notable. And he just, you know, told it in this laid-back kind of style that belied what was actually being told in the story. He once got invited to a producer's house down in Naples. And so he and his wife are spending the night at the producer's house. He wakes up the next morning. The paper's delivered to the house. The producer has been caught by the cops. He was smuggling cigarettes in on a speedboat overnight and had a shootout with the cops.
And the whole time he wasn't aware that his host was gone and having this shootout.
Yeah.
That's great. Going back to the Italian connection again, sorry, I got sidetracked there just thinking about Harrison. The other thing that I liked about the film was that Henry Silva is so cool in it, but he just keeps getting dissed all the time. You had mentioned earlier about the lady in the blue wig, like when Silva's just hardcore hitting on girls the whole time and just never seems to get any, other than maybe like prostitutes. There seem to be a ton of prostitutes in this film.
You know her?
I know her all right. I know the other one, too.
Yeah, well, they're both underage.
And they're both whores. You figure 100,000 liras a throw, 5 throws a week, that's 20 times a month. How much does that make?
2 million a month.
Talk about a good thing. And I even calculated a couple of days off a week, and those little bitches never take a day off if they can help it.
You know, it's part of the Italian machismo of the 70s. Your introduction to, or maybe not your introduction, but seeing Luca Canali slap around, you know, women and stuff, maybe you think, oh, well, he's not supposed to be likable after all. But I think Italian audiences of the 70s probably viewed that as not being anything special. You know, that was probably a little par for the course, the fact that, you know, guy had to slap a woman around to keep her in line a little bit. But yeah, there's a lot of women and, you know, shaking down prostitutes for information is almost a stock scene of these movies. And yeah, Silva shows up and tries to get information out of a bunch of prostitutes in one scene. And he's Mr. Moneybags and throwing money around, and all the prostitutes love him. But then it turns ugly and he has to start whooping on them a little.
Yeah, such great, great looking women in the film, and just great. You know, the thing that I really like about this, and you talked about it again in your documentary, was just all those close-ups and just the amazing faces that people have. I mean, Silva is just such an unusual looking guy, and when you get in real close with him, it's just like, wow, he's really got a lot of stuff going on in that mug of his.
Yeah, Silva, you know, has a face that's halfway between being a very handsome guy and being like a monster. He's just such an interesting face. And then some of the mob cronies in this film are, man, their faces are so interesting. They're just full of this thuggy ignorance.
Strode looked amazing in this as well. Also, you know, better when he didn't talk, as we were saying before. Yeah, just those close-ups of him. It was amazing, though, how much he had aged, because I'm very familiar with him with Once Upon a Time in the West, which was only just a few years before this, but he had seemed to age so much between the two films.
Yeah, his biceps are in tip-top shape, but yeah, his face looks a little, it has a few more years on it. Then it's kind of sadder still to see him in 80s movies like Vigilante, where he's supposed to be convincingly tough, and
Yeah, you kind of want to get him a chair or something, like, come on, you know, can I get you a glass of warm milk or something?
Oh, and at some point, don't let me forget, before we wrap this up, I got a couple of audio outtakes from Henry Silva from our Eurocrime interview with him. When we were doing Eurocrime, I kept hoping our interviewees were going to tell us interesting stories about the director of The Italian Connection, Fernando De Leo, because Fernando De Leo is like a very integral part of this whole revival movement. Quentin Tarantino keeps dropping his name. Everybody seems to be holding these Fernando De Leo retrospectives. But nobody, none of the interviewees really had much interesting to say about him. They just said these generic pleasantries like, oh, yes, great guy, Fernando de Leo, fabulous human being. And, you know, I can't use that. That's just generic as all get out. So I didn't do a section on Fernando de Leo. He's barely mentioned in the documentary at all. But Henry Silva did, you know, work with him a couple of times. So he had a couple of comments about Fernando. And here are some of those, if you can roll that, here are some of his more specific comments.
Fernando de Leo, when I first met him, I hardly spoke Italian. And he spoke like a machine gun. Oddly enough, I understood every word he said. We had a simpatico going, you know, that just, language didn't matter. So I did these two movies with him, and I wanted to continue, but unfortunately he passed away. One time I went to his home, and I was in the kitchen, and it was a little dark. I'm looking around, like I'm looking over there. I'm looking around, and there's darkness, and there's a little shine. What is that? It was a very famous painting. I don't remember the name of the painting, but it was about like this. The thing must have been worth, I don't know, a couple of million bucks. And he always dressed like a guy, very casually. He never wore his, you never saw the money in his clothes. I mean, he dressed simply, jeans and a shirt, and he was, I miss him. He was a great guy.
I have another Henry Silva outtake, too. This one cracks me up because, now, I didn't make it out to L.A. for the Henry Silva interview, but I wrote the questions. And when I get the tapes back from our co-producer, Mike Martinez, I watch tape one. And here's Silva telling this anecdote about working with Woody Strode on The Italian Connection. And I put in tape two, and the crew is bustling about, and it begins in the middle of Silva retelling that same Woody Strode anecdote. He's been telling it to the crew as they're, you know, changing tapes and, you know, adjusting the lights and whatever. So then the crew settles. They're getting ready to, you know, get back into the questions. And Silva says, before we get back into the questions, I want to tell that story about Woody Strode. And so he tells it a third time. And so here's that third telling of that story.
Ask me about Woody Strode. I don't give a damn. You know, just... Just everything I ought to, it doesn't matter where, here, there, it doesn't matter.
You can cut it. You worked with Strode on a lot of films, mostly with for De Leo. I mean, was that like a coincidence, or De Leo liked the dynamic?
I think he did. And there was a scene where we were in a what they call a garage, not a garage, but a cemetery of cars, broken cars. And I looked over at Woody. And he's picking up this car, and he just threw it. I said, what the hell did you just do? You picked up this car, and you threw it? I mean, do you enjoy throwing cars? Is that your thing? Jesus. My God. And then I tried it. Forget it.
Wow, it took him three times to get that story in its completion. That's great. I love Henry Silva. You're right about Silva's face because he was a little bit monstrous. I mean, the guy played so many different ethnicities in his career. I remember I just watched Manchurian Candidate again yesterday, and he's in there as an Asian guy, and he's played, you know, Spanish and Italian and all these things. I mean, he was all over the place, but he was always great no matter what role that he was in.
With the possible exception of Day of the Assassins. That's the one time where Silva, I think, phoned it in.
I was afraid you were going to say Megaforce, so I'm glad.
Oh,
that...
yeah, leave it to me to have not seen an 80s film. I'm so much into 70s films, almost to the exclusion of everything else. But yeah, Day of the Assassins, he's stuck behind a desk just to put another name on the marquee, and so I think he was aware of that fact and phoned it in. In fact, he probably spent most of the film literally on the phone.
Now, was Silva in any spaghetti westerns? I'm trying to think of one, but I can't really picture him in any of the westerns.
Only a single spaghetti western. He was in a lot of good American westerns, like The Bravados, but his only single spaghetti western was The Hills Run Red.
Tell me a little bit more, too, about the Italian filmmakers. I mean, you talked about their very specific way of making films. I will admit, and I told you this at the beginning of when we were talking and months ago, too, is I'm not that into Italian films that much, but I like that they have their different movements and their different genres as they go along. You know, I love Italian westerns a lot, but then when it comes to giallo or Eurocrime itself or the sword and sandal films, I am very specific as far as which ones that I like and which ones that I don't. But why did they go through these different very clear-cut cycles. I mean, and I guess zombie films would be another one as we go through here. But what is it about the Italian films that makes them just so different, but yet, even when I'm looking at these things, it feels like they're kind of speaking back to American films with the way that they're doing these things?
Well, yeah, that's the whole bizarre irony of the Italian genre films, is that it kind of began as an intent to copycat big American hits. And in doing so, inadvertently, they came up with something completely different, partially based on their crazy filmmaking style. It just couldn't help to, you know, their own style just seeps into their movies. Something with like the spaghetti Western, obviously, after Sergio Leone's Man with No Name films, when they became a big hit, they obviously realized they were onto something and they started stylizing them in a certain way. But Eurocrime movies, yeah, they have tons of style, but it doesn't seem to be a deliberate style. It seems to be just like this inadvertent style that just, you look at a Eurocrime movie and you're like, okay, that's very clearly not an American cop movie, because they shot some in America. They're imbued with this style that you almost can't put a fine point on sometimes.
Now, one of the films that I consider it a Eurocrime film, but I'm not sure if you would. I love the film The Burglars, the one with Jean-Paul Belmondo and Omar Sharif. I'm not sure if you've seen that one. I'm sure you have.
Oh, yes, indeed. That was one of the films that really upped the ante on the vehicular pursuits in Eurocrime.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Wow. I mean, while I was watching it, I was thinking of that remake of The Italian Connection, and I was just like, wow, those guys have nothing on The Burglars. It was just amazing.
Yeah, that was a stunt coordinator and stunt driver named Remy Julien, a Frenchman who coordinated that car chase. And he worked in Eurocrime through most of the 70s and was good enough, proved himself as being the best in the world. And so the James Bond films got him in the late 70s and through the 80s and even into the 90s.
I really enjoyed The Italian Connection, and I'm glad that I watched it, because I don't think I would have watched it had I not had your guidance on this one, because there are just so many movies to choose from, and I had no idea where to start. I mean, apparently I'd seen one with The Burglars, but really didn't even realize it. But as far as you're concerned, what are some of the other good primer films? What are some of the films that myself and some of the listeners should get into if they're interested in Eurocrime films?
Well, again, sticking with the one man against the world theme, the film that Fernando De Leo made right before The Italian Connection was Caliber 9, a very similar one man against the world kind of scenario. I'm a big fan of Lee Van Cleef, and he did an excellent one man against the world film called The Perfect Killer. But man, that is sleazy as all get out. A woman gets shot in the genitals, tranny fights with a straight razor. So be prepared for some major sleaze in that one. And then there's a great, The Angry Cop was best played by an actor named Maurizio Merli. He made one called Rome Armed to the Teeth. But that movie is kind of bloated in its first 20 minutes, because it starts with this unrelated 20-minute thing. So this plot thing that just kind of introduces you to his character and then just goes nowhere. So if you can see it in the cut called Assault with a Deadly Weapon, because that trims down that first 20 minutes. In fact, I was invited to the University of Tampa to do lecturing on Eurocrime as part of a world cinema class. And the class showed Rome Armed to the Teeth, and then The Italian Connection. And when Rome Armed to the Teeth started, I was like, oh man, I forgot how bloated this first 20 minutes were and how extraneous it was. And so I kind of felt people fidgeting in their seats, and I actually split. And when I came back, The Italian Connection was on, and I was like, good grief, they've already, you know, watched a long movie. Are they going to even be into this? And these were early 20-somethings, and I kept hearing them make noise in the theater, and I thought that, they were talking amongst themselves and getting bored and distracted, but they were totally reacting to Luca Cannelli's Fight for Survival. I was really impressed with the impact that movie made.
I had talked before about the Italian films were a lot of a reaction to American films, but even when you got into like spaghetti Westerns, like after Clint Eastwood made those Man with No Name movies, came back to the U.S. and continued to make some Westerns. So it was like he and some other filmmakers were taking that Italian sensibility and imbuing it into American films. Can you think of any American films that were directly correlated to the Eurocrime genre?
Well, it's a different matter because you're right. The Dollars movies came to America and were big hits, so that explains something like Two Mules for Sister Sarah, an American right. film that plays like a spaghetti Western. Now, the Eurocrime movies were not popular in America, so that phenomenon never happened.
Oh, that's kind of a shame. The thing that I love the most about the spaghetti Westerns and about Eurocrime is it felt like they were giving actors a second chance because it seemed like, you know, and you had mentioned this in your film as far as like people that were on the blacklist being able to be in these films, like Lionel Stander being in Once Upon a Time in the West, and just seeing these kind of career resurgences. Who do you think did it the best coming from the doldrums of an American career and coming into an Italian career and just really showing their stuff for what they weren't necessarily appreciated for in their home country?
At the risk of being very Silva heavy in this episode, it's fabulous. Somebody like Silva, who was a character actor in America, went to Italy and did all these lead roles, both as, heroes and villains. He was just fabulous. And, same with John Saxon. It's great that somebody who basically at that time was a character actor got to play lead roles in Eurocrime movies. For the younger actors, it gave a lot of them a chance to work with these legendary actors who were, maybe a little tiny bit washed up, but, one of our interviewees, Leonard Mann, got to work with James Mason on a Eurocrime movie. And he said it was just amazing to hear that familiar voice that he had heard all, for a couple of decades, come down the hall onto set for the first time. James Mason blows his first line and apologizes to Leonard Mann. And Leonard Mann is just like, this is so surreal. I can't believe James Mason just walked on set and apologized to me. James Mason, Lee J. Cobb, Joseph Cotten even, all these legendary American and British actors became character actors and mob bosses and stuff in Eurocrime movies.
Yeah, well, I was always a big fan of Lee Van Cleef as well, and I was so glad when he moved into the Italian Westerns, and then he seemed to continue naturally into the Eurocrime stuff. As far as what I know, I don't know if you concur or not.
Van Cleef was a little too stubborn, I think. Van Cleef stuck with the Westerns. He only made 3 Eurocrime movies, stayed with the Westerns for most of the 70s, even though they were long out of favor. So he ended up making Italian-Israeli co-productions and stuff as far as Westerns. But I really loved the 3 Eurocrime movies he did.
And then Master Ninja, but I know that's not European at all. That's American through and through.
Master Ninja was the 80s TV show he did called The Master. And I remember buying the video cassette at Walmart, and I walk up to the checkout stand at the electronics section, and I put The Master down. And of course, Lee Van Cleef is barely anywhere to be found on the cover. There's a picture of Demi Moore because she had been a guest star in the first episode. And so I set the tape down, and there were 2 geriatric guys working the counter, and one of them says, "So you like Demi Moore, huh?" And the other guy says, "Yeah, that Demi Moore, she's a hog." And the first guy says, "She's a hog? What do you mean?" And he says, "I'd let her wallow in my trough." And then the first guy, these are both, 260-something or 70-something guys. The first guy says, "I put her booty on my plate." So that was my experience buying The Master on video cassette in the 90s at Walmart.
That story is almost better than The Master itself. All right. With that, let's take another break. We're going to play a clip from next week's show.
I am Sadhu, master of the theater of the macabre.
Prepare yourself for the horror. Prepare yourself for the terror. Prepare yourself for the ultimate blood-curdling experience.
Blood-sucking freaks!
In all the history of evil, there has never been anything or anyone to equal the demented mind of Sadhu.
Oh, now we're getting the proper reaction.
Ow! He was an evil genius of pain, with the most bizarre machines and tools ever created to torture the body of woman. Yes, torture, and torture, and torture, but keeping that once beautiful body alive so it can suffer more and more and more.
But if you are skeptical or bored, then just pretend that what you see is real.
Possessed possessed by his evil. The tortured become the torturers. He turned young virgins into flesh-eating cannibals and set them loose in a frenzy of pain-filled orgies. Sardou. He was the creator and the director. He was the master of
blood-sucking freaks.
A show that will make anyone wretch.
That was a preview for next week's show on Blood-Sucking Freaks, where I'll be joined by our special guest, Robert St. Mary of WDET here in Detroit. So I want to thank my guest this week, Mike Malloy, for coming on and giving me a much-needed education.
Well, was it Freud who said the best Eurocrime fan is the one inside each of us?
It might have been. So, Mike, for folks who are interested in your documentary, where can they go to see previews, clips, where it's playing, all that kind of stuff?
The latest centralization of updates has been on Facebook, on the Facebook page, facebook.com/Eurocrime. But I got to give props to the web board Love, Lock, and Load, because those guys were my original cheerleaders on this project.
What is the status of the film right now? I mean, would you consider it done, or is there more work to be done on it? Because I know that there have been different cuts as you've gone along.
Yeah, I keep trimming down the current cut. I would like to get that completely locked. It's basically locked right now, but I'd like to get that cut completely locked, and that'll be right over 2 hours, and hope that that can be preserved somehow in case there's interest in an extended DVD cut. But then after that, I'll need to start chopping it down in case there's broadcast interest.
Taking it down to what, like 90 minutes or something, 63?
Yeah, somewhere between 90 minutes and an hour, 45 minutes, because it's possible this could play on a cable station with no commercials, and I want to cram as much information in there as possible. You mentioned some other cult cinema documentaries we've had, and some of those kind of just are really sensationalistic, and I really wanted Eurocrime to be, yes, exciting and briskly paced and energetic and stuff, but I also want to cram as much information in there as possible, really make somebody feel like they learned something about Italian cinema and the Eurocrime genre.
Right, exactly, because you're not just giving, here are all these clips, you know, look at how many times this J&B bottle appears, all those kind of things, but you're actually giving the reason for behind it, you know, you're saying, like, as you mentioned earlier, that there wasn't a whole lot of television going on at the time, so they used movies as their escape route and all this, and so that's what I appreciate about it. It's like a very, very entertaining and interesting essay about this movement of film. And I really appreciate that. So because I do, I feel like I've walked away, and not only can I speak intelligently to it, but I can also tell other people a little bit about it and say, oh, well, did you know? And then fill their heads with all these fun-filled facts that I've learned from your film. So I appreciate that very much.
In short, I didn't want it to be just knockers and machine guns.
Yeah, well, but you do have those moments that really grab you and really wow you. I mean, all those car chases, you know, the montage of that, and just, you know, the scene that I enjoy the most is when you go through all the different types of violence that they have and all the different, like, you know, the tranny fights and the piss torture. I never even knew that piss torture existed until I saw this film.
Yeah, and apparently it was written from true life.
Wow, really? That's the way that they would handle their problems?
It's a common way, apparently, for the mob to show disrespect. It makes a certain sense.
Yeah, and what was up with all the trannies and all the tranny fights?
Oh, I don't know. You know, American films like Freebie and the Bean also, you know, they seem to delight in a little bit of gay bashing.
All right. Well, thanks again for coming on. I really appreciate it. It was great to hear some of these stories, and I hope that folks will go and check out your movie. And I hope that it gets some sort of proper release, because it really deserves it. I'm not just saying that because we've been friends for years, but it's something that more folks need to see. Same thing with The Italian Connection. Folks can go out and find The Italian Connection relatively easily. I mean, because there is this Fernando De Leo revival going on. So a lot of his movies are now available on DVD. Very easily to find, and they should look for it under The Italian Connection as opposed to any of those other titles that we are bandying about, correct?
Yeah, especially not Manhunt in the City, because as we discussed, that's a different film.
Exactly. All right. So thanks again for listening, everybody. Be sure to check back for more episodes of The Projection Booth on iTunes via Stitcher or on Jackalope Radio. And you can also get the lowdown on our website at projection-booth.com. This week, we'll be linking over to Mike's Eurocrime documentary so folks can keep up to date with that. So thanks again, Mike. It's been a pleasure having you on.
Adios. Put her booty on my plate.